Chapter 15. The True Life, Part 1. There are many conditions of life, of individualized existence, characterized by great differences. There is a world of difference in the state of life between a Westerner and a remote forest dweller. There is a gaping, wide chasm of difference between human beings living in the material sphere and those living in the reflection sphere. Therefore, one could itemize tens of differences when considering entities in their classes and groups, in their social or natural religious traits. There is, however, one thing that all life known to us has in common: the completely individualized existence in this dialectical nature order. It is an animated life which adapts and submits itself completely to the norms and laws of the material sphere and the reflection sphere. It is a life which can be subjected to a certain culture. It is possible that someone born in a wooden hut in the jungles of Borneo is later to be found as a doctor, a renowned surgeon, in a wholly different centre of culture, avidly occupied with the appendix of lady or sir, so and so. We may perhaps find later on a once jungle dweller as a teacher at a renowned university. The pauper of a former time can be the prominent authority of today. We simply want to say that racial or class discrimination has no fundamental basis. If all life were given equal prospects, all life would be able to move on the same cultural level and achieve anything within the framework of its field of life. Think, for example, of the behavior of natural religion, its ministers, and countless followers. Eternal bliss is offered to all, whether rich or poor, black, white, or brown. That is the reason why natural religious groups aim to develop what one can call a metaphysical culture in everyone who makes contact with them. It is clear to us that the same applies to art and science. Religion, art and science, and as generally approached in life, are culturally open to all people, for all of life. There is a great diversity in the lines of development, and one can follow several lines at the same time or modify them. The result is a certain state of being that is generally referred to as the level of civilization or culture. We must further note that whatever lines of development one may follow, their fundamental nature is totally the same. For example, think of a teacher of religion. He trains through studying. When that is completed, he is a teacher. The same can be said of someone practicing a particular art or science. Our religious nature shows when a particular teaching, author, or ethos resonates and connects with our state of being. Our character, or our senses, or our consciousness, all formed by the past, becomes sensitive to a specific teaching. The teacher gives us standards, laws, lessons. The teacher says that if we are prepared to live according to these laws, the cultural consequences will raise us above our former state, which is indeed the case. The same applies to our potential artistic or scientific sensitivity, due to which we live from certain artistic and scientific needs with all their cultural consequences. It can therefore be established without any doubt that religion, art, and science are firstly freely approachable by everyone, and secondly, they constitute unmistakable civilizing results. It does not matter what you choose, religion, art, or science, or religion with a little art, or art with a little religion, or art and science, whichever, each one will raise you above the starting point until what? That until is determined philosophically and hypothetically, but not precisely. For us in the material sphere, the road leads mostly to death in death. What lies beyond is for most not to be ascertained. One can only speculate about the unknown. It is certain that religion, art, and science, though undoubtedly cultivating, do not make humankind happier. However much cultivated, human beings remain poor wretches who slowly calcify as they approach the frontiers of death. Religion, art, and science provide a pastime in the lugubrious game of the struggle for life, of love and hate, of the struggle against death, which at birth has already gripped us with its tentacles. We immerse for a time into a sermon or discourse we hear or literature we read. We drift away in the ethers to some music, Debussy, for example, or we lose ourselves for an hour or more in a formula, a set way of saying or doing something. Marx said religion is the opium of the people. With the same right, we could say art, science, and religion are opium, a heavy narcotic for the people. We do not want to take away your pastimes, for you have need of them in this nature of death, but do distinguish well the essence of all culture. Our life is positively one with the nature of death, so culture of death gives birth to death. Why do we write about these things? To make it clear that we each move along a certain lifeline, that in our momentary state of being we stem from a certain level of life. We can certainly cultivate this life, elevate it in a thousand different ways, but this culture cannot set us free. The cultivation of our life can even keep us busy, potentially feverishly busy. We are taught and we teach ourselves, but of the heavenly kingdom about which every metaphysical culture speculates, there is no sign. That is why Paul said that the Jews lack the heavenly kingdom, because they seek it through deeds of the law of Moses, through the righteousness of the ethical law. What is the ethical or moral law? It is a method of culture. Who was Moses? He was a hierophant of the old method, the old dispensation. There are hierophants of the old dispensation and of the new dispensation. What does that mean? Why did Moses establish a method of culture, a moral law? Because a method of culture, that is to say, culture of life, drives humanity to a crisis. Culture is matter-binding. Culture of anything of this nature leads to a criterion of nature. All of us who live here have to learn through experience that our nature is bound up with death. We cannot learn that through suffering and sorrow. For when we experience pain and grief, we think, for example, I have done something wrong, or someone else caused it. We can best learn and understand the great lesson only through the culture of life, through the practice of art, science, and natural religion in all their countless variations and combinations. That is the old system, the old testamentary period, in which all of humanity lives and is ceaselessly driven from criterion to criterion. The practice of the ethical laws of Moses with the method of culture belonging to it sharpens our consciousness, causes it to react better, so that finally, at the summit of this consciousness, we can ascertain for ourselves with unquestionable certainty the great deficiency of life. That is why it says in the old moral law, follow the hierophant into the land promised by him until you arrive at a turning point. In this connection, we must note that Moses himself does not enter the so-called promised land of the Jews. When they jubilantly enter the Canaan of their dreams, their hierophant had disappeared. And when, in their criterion, they undertake every type of experience to realize their material fulfillment, it always ends in a sea of misery and woe. In the mythical narrative, the Jews continue to seek and wander. Then comes a whole series of prophets, and every one of them is a new hierophant of the old dispensation, or an envoy of one of them. They all have the task of leading the Jews back to their criterion, the greatest being Elijah, until the last of the prophets comes, John the Baptist, the last prophet of the old dispensation, and he refers to the hierophant of the new dispensation, Jesus the Lord. Then finally comes the glorification on the mountain. Moses, Elijah, and Jesus stand next to each other in great glory, showing that all hierophants come from the same brotherhood and emanate from the same light. If we now grasp this whole process, the situation is as follows. Take a human being who rediscovers himself in the nature of death. He is drawn along in a cultural process, the purpose of which is to lead him to insight of his real, factual state of being. He then arrives at his culture criterion in the despair of this insight. He struggles with great effort to outrun his fate, forever grasping at new and different cultural methods which invariably lead to the said criterion or crisis. This totally Old Testamentary cultural process can be distinguished in 12 times two aspects, which are all characterized by the individual's attempt to break free and a corresponding hierophantic rejection. When such a process has run its natural law-related course, the human being concerned is placed before the new dispensation, and the hierophant thereof comes to meet him. When the person concerned reacts, the morning of liberation has dawned. All who enter the school of the Rosy Cross are called to this freedom. By this, we mean that the school of the modern Rosy Cross does not stand in the old system of the cultural criteria, but in the vibration of the new call to freedom. The pupil who reacts to this call furnishes the proof, which he discovers with his culture-purified consciousness, that there are two natures, two life realities, which are totally independent of each other and are mutually positively different to each other. The pupil now beholds a new reality that he cannot enter, but which he can approach through the righteousness of faith, of belief. He, she stands before the righteousness and the reality of Christ, the hierophant of the new bond, the revealer of the new dispensation. In this phase, the pupil knows that the law of Moses and the activity of the hierophantic prophets had been necessarily offered to lead the flesh-bound soul to its criterion in life, and that the reality of Jesus Christ refers to a wholly other different state of soul, that of the spiritual or original nature. Only a microcosm that can ascend into the universal realm of the Christ Spirit may truly speak of life and can say, I live, I am. We can enter this life as a microcosmic system when we say farewell to the old nature, the nature of death, in complete voluntary mortification of the I central self. When we stand in this leave-taking, the new life is born atomically in the manifestation field of the auric being. The entry of the spirit atomically in the manifestation field of the auric being is mystically designated as the birth of the Son of Eternal Divinity. Therefore, it is certain that the human being who has not given birth to the Son of the Spirit has no real knowledge of the one true divinity. No one knows the essentials of real divinity and its lamb before they are revealed in the system. Life, as it is meant by the holy language, does not mean. Believing that somewhere there is a universal spirit, but knowing, experiencing, that it is so. To know the word of truth, to know one's spirit born in our heart and soul, means it has given inner birth to its pure offspring, the atomic influx of the Spirit, the Son, and thereby to know with absolute certainty that one is connected with the universal divine realm. The congregation of the real Christ is built upon this rock of the actual revelation of Christ in the manifestation field of the auric being. A congregation is a brotherhood. Therefore, the pupil who greets the atomic entry of the Spirit in the manifestation field is simultaneously a participant of the congregation of Christ, a participant of the universal brotherhood. This proves that a pupil is never called or chosen into the brotherhood, but is taken up into it through rebirth. Who stands in the inner certainty of this rebirth knows with us that this is the one unshakable basis of certainty regarding true life. Who cannot yet experience this certainty is still immersed in the Old Testamentary period in the ceaseless drive from one criterion to the other, in perpetual hope and fear. Such a human being will continue in the rotation of the nature of death until he has received the new revelation through self-mortification in rebirth. All who are able to receive this revelation behold it face to face in first-hand knowledge. They can no longer be at cross purposes with each other, for they stand as a brother and sister unity in the congregation of Christ.